I'm not sure why I called. I guess I really just wanted to talk to you. And I was thinking maybe later on we could get together for a while. It's been such a long time and I really do miss your smile. I'm not talking about millennium and I don't want to change your life.
All right, here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am your host, Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, the Jedi Cole Houston.
Coming to you live from our studios in Hell's Kitchen.
We actually just left our studios in Metropolis.
That's right.
And went to our studios at Hell's Kitchen, which
we'll be returning because apparently Metropolis and Hell's Kitchen are across the street from each other as well.
Right. You're literally a stone skips away from Gotham, which I don't think we ever really knew that until Dark Knight Batman versus Superman came out. But tonight we are here to talk about season 2 of Daredevil. In issue 176 of Hey Kids Comics, we got a fancy name for this one?
This is, I can't remember what, this is a Baton to the Face 2, or I'd rather be watching Daredevil 2.
That's right. If you remember our first one, we were super stoked for the first season of Daredevil, and equally stoked for the second season.
Rather beside ourselves back then. There literally was Daredevil and then whatever else we had to do day to day.
Which kind of the way it was, I don't think I realized it as much this time, but we did finish season 2 of Daredevil in like 3 days. I don't think I realized how much we powered through it until it was over. And I'm like, wait, what? It's only been 3 days. How's it over already? But it was good.
I could have sworn there were more episodes left.
They set the bar real high with season 1.
It was a tough act to follow, to say the least.
So what did they? Do you think that they met the challenge?
I think they did. It was a very difficult thing because the natural, or what it appeared at first blush, is that you're jumping into the middle of the all-too-common temptation with anything superhero to double down on your next incarnation. So, if one villain was great in the first one, bring in three for the next. And so, the Punisher / Elektra
right
thing was both exciting and worrisome, I think, going in.
It was for me, too. I really had, I had my suspicions before the season launched. My speculation was that you were going to see a war between Punisher and Elektra with Daredevil caught in the middle.
Yeah, I almost was half expecting Punisher to take on the bullseye killing Elektra role.
So here's the thing up front. If you haven't spent the 13 hours watching the second season of Daredevil, go do it now. Then restart the show. It'll only take you 12 hours. I don't know how that time continuum works, but
it literally time bullets you.
It does. It omega beams you back in time 1 hour. Just one, though. It's not a full-time bullet. Go watch it now, because we are going to spoil the shit out of this show. So just
Other than what you now know, if you haven't seen it yet, that it isn't a war between Elektra and Punisher, then you'll find out far too much more if you continue to listen if you haven't seen it yet. And if you haven't seen it yet, shame on you. You can get back to life later.
Here's the thing about season 1 and season 2 is it sets the bar for any comic book license that's going to be on TV and the movies so high that you have no choice but to compare everything you see to it. And
that is true.
And you start to see it bleed through into other things, which I think was really cool. I was watching the last episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. down right before the show started, and I was watching, they had one close quarter fight scene, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, unlike all the other episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., where it's all these kind of high bombast, across the room, Hurricane Rana flying through the air fight scenes, they are mano a mano, they're fist fights, but, there's a lot of
punching your opponent to the other side of the room so you can have time to
right.
one or both of you can grab a chair.
These fight scenes were much more up close and personal and much more paced like you would see in Daredevil. So I like the fact that maybe this is starting to bleed over, that people realize that while not everything has to be dark, super dark and broody, Zack Snyder, you can inject a little bit of realism into this and make it more fun, make it more guttural, I think.
What's interesting with Daredevil in both seasons is that those fight scenes that illustrate, you know, the brutality of even just having a unarmed combat.
Oh, it's nasty,
and this even further underscored, and again, just full of surprises.
So why don't you recap us real quick on, because my memory's for poop, why don't you recap us where we began? Like, where did first season end, essentially? Like, what note did we end on?
We're ending on a unique note in that the first season was the hero's journey. You see, you have the slow progression of Matt Murdock into the Daredevil, while simultaneously giving some insight into how is this even possible?
Right.
And it culminates into twofold situation where you get your Daredevil by the end, and you also you see the first villain born, as it were, and the first major victory and the first taste of what it's going to be to mean to be Daredevil.
Right.
Because we now have upped the bar from, you know, stopping the odd purse snatcher or rapist or, you know, carjacking or what have you, to having to deal with an implacable enemy who can attack you from not only physically, but in many ways mentally by manipulating situations and in
financially, you know, however he wants to come at
you. Calculating,
right,
villain who, in his own words in season two, is playing a long game.
But also, the flip side to we see Matt Murdock's hero's journey into becoming Daredevil is we see Wilson Fisk's journey into becoming the Kingpin.
Side by side, together.
And it was brilliant. And we also see the iconic Daredevil costume be born throughout the season. As he grows, his image grows. You know, his Daredevil imagery comes into focus. By the end, he's got the iconic red suit and a couple billy clubs, and he's ready to rock and roll, as the in the parlance.
He's got the horn head going on, yeah, and then, of course, in season one, like you said, you see that the villain's journey, and you see the escalation of it's almost the Joker argument from Tim Burton. You know, you made me, I made you.
Right, and you get to see that even more so in the next season, so basically the season ends with Matt Murdock deciding that he's going to walk both of these paths and figure out how to make it all work. You know, he's going to do law, and he's going to be a vigilante, and he's going to make it all work. And for a while, it does.
Yeah.
And for a while, it does.
It is possible, even though he gets roundly beaten on a routine basis.
Just all the time. Just viciously beaten. But we open season two with... Okay, I've got to say this up front before we go any further.
Yeah.
My biggest trepidation, my biggest, you know, walking on eggshells with this was the idea of the Punisher. Because we've seen at least three or four different versions of the Punisher now on TV or the big screen. You know, he's a very tricky character to get right. And
he's also one of those characters that really should have just been a flash in the pan type of character. The fact that the Punisher has remained a staple for decades is rather staggering to me, because he really is a one-trick pony.
He is, except when done correctly, he's very nuanced and very layered, which was my concern, was are they going to ham-fist this, or are they going to nuance it? And they nuanced it beautifully.
The thing is, at this point, we shouldn't be scared that that's going to be
right.
Because not only has Netflix delivered on Daredevil already by this point,
Right.
And brilliantly so. I mean, Daredevil to me was like a, you know, C-list Marvel character. I was familiar with the character. I'd read a few tales, but I just was never a character that appealed to me on a broad level until this. And then it was like, oh my God, this is like everything ever done right with Daredevil all rolled into one, but with some original take as well. It wasn't just we're adapting the best Frank Miller Daredevil. We're paying tribute to the best Frank Miller Daredevil, but we're not necessarily retelling chapter and verse. And then they follow that up with Jessica Jones, which is like, why would I give a damn about Jessica? Oh, that's why, okay.
Right, exactly. You got me again, Netflix. Yeah, got me again. But you open up the season with the Punisher. You open up the season with a bloodbath of a gang war that was started by the Punisher, and it is some of the most... Anybody who's out there, and I said it about season one, which was this is a superhero show version of The Wire that was on HBO, and they upped the ante on this. Like they made
absolutely,
you know, because you have Frank Castle, who, like all good superheroes, should never name themselves, never called himself the Punisher until later in the season. He basically just decimates an Irish bar. An Irish pub just lights it up,
but it's, in all fairness, it's full of Irish gangsters.
True,
which I know that you would vehemently deny exists. But
hey, I have nothing to do. I cannot confirm nor deny those allegations.
And I have a friend of Italian heritage who playfully denies the mob. So.
No, but my favorite thing about
is a big fan of the Untouchables.
Oh, of course. Who knows? What he's trying to say. No, but my favorite part of those first few episodes were the fact that the cops all kept saying it was an elite hit squad. They've all got military training, when of course it's just Frank Castle.
Exactly.
Which I thought was a really cool nod. Like, there's no way. There's no way. And then finally they go into that meatpacking plant and the guy's like, it's one man. And everybody's like, oh, say what? But the cool thing that they do is, you know, we thought, okay, it's going to be tough last season to do a hero's journey and a villain's journey and show us that with supporting characters. It's going to be tough, but they pulled it off. Are they going to be able to show us a continuation of that journey along with two new journeys and forward development of the supporting cast? Yeah, they can do it. They showed us that they can do it. God damn it if they didn't pull it off.
Well, and the thing is that the biggest fear with your supporting cast in a superhero type situation is small-villing the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Your anticipation is a steady stream of, are you hiding something from me, Clark? And then that Tom Welling kind of, pursed lip, nod of the head, bobbing of the head type of thing that became a trademark. And frankly, that gets tiresome after a while. They did a brilliant job of the reveal. You know, who do you tell? Well, you tell your best friend. Of course, no, your best friend is not going to be thrilled about this. And
right.
The combination of deceit up to that point and being the voice of reason that you're completely nuts.
And genuine fear for your best friend's safety at all times. And they do a great...
Also being put in the you're Pete Jonesing it, where you're putting in the untenable situation of being the one person that... all the intelligence could be tortured out of.
Yeah, you have no plausible deniability at this point. You are the one in the know. But
Foggy's about as prepared to stand up to the rigors of interrogation as Eugene from The Walking Dead.
Oh, Eugene, poor Eugene. But they the first arc of this season is the Punisher. Now, I had my concerns, because what they do in the first, five episodes of the show is the Punisher is... it's a really good telling, because you've got you got your key origin stories that everybody knows. The Waynes are shot in Crime Alley. Krypton explodes. Bitten by a radioactive spider. Even Daredevils, most people would know. You know, yeah. If you were, there's no, and it's finite. There's no changing it, really. Like, it is it is what it is. The Frank Castle origin story, though, has been so nebulous and all over the place that it's very hard to pin down. You know, the bouillabaisse, the roux at the bottom of the pan is his family was killed by mobsters. Okay, fair enough, but how are you going to do this and make it without being a one-note, story?
And at what point does that alone push you
exactly
to wage a one-man war with heavy ordnance?
But they do a brilliant job of in the first 4 or 5 issues establishing Frank Castle as a vigilante, Daredevil having to go after Frank Castle, not only because Frank Castle is, shooting everyone in Hell's Kitchen, essentially, but also because he's a real genuine, I think, threat to the moral compass. That he's what Daredevil can become in a vacuum. You know, he's what Daredevil can become.
And he also is becomes a, why ruin it for the rest of us? They're part of an elite growing, the vigilante is being born.
Right.
And being largely accepted based on a certain code of honor that has illustrated the unwritten law, as it were. And then here comes some hack hoving into town, shooting up the place like it's the Old West. And it's like, no, you're going to ruin it for everybody. This is, you're single-handedly giving us all a bad name.
Right. And there are, in that first 5 episodes, there are some brilliant, like what is it, the Dogs of War? Is that the name of the biker gang?
Something like that, the Dogs of Hell or...
Dogs of Hell, that's it. Because they were actually referenced in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., so that's your first crossover.
Oh, nice!
Yeah, there was a back in, I think, season 1 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Dogs of Hell are referenced in that as well as in this, so there may be some... I know this is an aside, a tangent, but I want so badly for this Daredevil to be in the Civil War movie.
Oh, I know. I would love that. It would also be fun to have him or Jessica Jones or somebody cross over into Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because at the end of each episode, there's the ABC logo right there.
Right, right.
So there is certainly precedent for those television universes to cross, but I would only want that to happen if it made some kind of sense. It's like,
right.
I don't want them to all of a sudden, quick, everybody, half of us have to go to Hell's Kitchen for reasons.
Exactly. I think we'll probably have to wait till Heroes for Hire for that to happen. But they take this idea that Frank Castle, his and they take it to the next level, but they fight. There's this brilliant, and we talked about last season, the hallway scene, the now seminal hallway fight scene, where it's the single shot, down the hallway fight scene with Matt, where we really for the first time we really get to see what he can do, and it's just brutal and short and impactful, and you get to see the exhaustion of what a real fight might look like on that scale, where it's just tired and physical, and but you have to keep going and you have to keep fighting, and then they decide, hey, you know what? We did that. So how's about a single tracking shot down an entire flight of stairs?
Yes.
With a biker gang. And it's just like, holy shit. Just brutal. And you get that same exhaustion, but it just doesn't stop. And the cool thing about that fight scene is he's more in control of his abilities at that point. So there's a lot more no-look punches.
Yes.
And a lot more cool, like at one point he has a chain, which why he didn't have a chain all the time bothers me, because that was badass. But he's, he's hitting people behind him and to the side of him and ducking, so the other people, it's brilliant. And it's like 7 minutes long.
Exactly.
It's just like, holy shit, this is insane.
Also, going back a moment to the kind of ethical code, one of the things that's unique about the Punisher, this characterization, is that he does have a code. It's a very stilted code. It's a very personalized code. But, you know, he will go out of his way and waste valuable time. He could be killing someone who deserves it to beat the daylights out of Daredevil.
Right, right.
Chain him up.
Oh, man. That was how great an hour of TV was that episode. Based on Punisher number 3, which is Garth Ennis, and it's almost panel for panel.
Yeah.
Chained to a pole with a gun taped to his hand. You're going to have to kill me or I'm killing them. Man.
Yeah, and basically putting him in that, in the situation where, you know, there comes a time when your moral code isn't enough. And, you know, Daredevil's able to transcend that, but it also helps to illustrate the fact that in his war on crime, he's not just going to go out into, you know, if Johnny Big Balls is coming.
He's my favorite gangster.
I love Johnny Big Balls.
Because the Dick Tracy villain, right?
Johnny. Yeah, it was. We basically just had these big balls that his henchmen had to carry around for him.
He had two midgets. They had to carry around his big balls.
He was very fond of dodgeball, or as we called it in school, slobber knocker. And they would get... It's his thing, you know. Like, oh, boss again. Like, now all right, get on the court. Let's go, boys.
Now I don't know whether I'm going to call him Johnny Big Balls or Slobber Knocker. Is that later? Is Slobber Knocker like
when comes Slobber Knocker?
He becomes okay, but yeah, he falls into the vat and comes out, and he's like, "I am Slobber Knocker."
Slobber Knocker.
And then his balls come out of the vat. It's two separate reveals.
Entirely different thing there. But, you know, when he and his entourage are coming down the street, you know, they're like walking through Soho or Little China or something, Frank Castle is just going to pop up out of a manhole and start shooting willy-nilly.
Right, right.
He is going to make sure every bullet, in as so much as possible, hits a, you know, every bullet has the name of somebody who deserves it on it. That he's not just going to plow through the innocent to get to the guilty.
Right. It would have been very easy for him to have killed Daredevil at any point. Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. He's got high-powered rifle. He kind of knows, he's proven that he's smart enough to know, you know, how to track and pattern and profile someone like Daredevil. He could have tracked him down and put a bullet in his head from a half a mile away. He could have done it, but he didn't. Instead, he beat the crap out of him on a couple occasions instead of killing him in a brilliant rooftop fight scene, which was an homage to a Frank Miller fight scene in one of the comics. But that was a great fight scene. And then, yes, he does. He chains him up. And tests him.
But it also, one of the other things that it does very brilliantly about the character of, this is a character who, you know, as a sniper, kills at a distance. He strikes at his enemies invisibly and from a distance. And, you know, the old adage, you know, that a sniper is a coward's profession if it's the enemy sniper.
Right, right.
otherwise you're a hero. But also the thing about it is, a sniper needs a steady hand and a good eye, but in general, a sniper isn't going to be engaged routinely in hand-to-hand combat.
Right.
Especially in to the level to which neither of you want to kill each other. Because that's what you had, was an epic fist fight between two individuals who wanted nothing more than to put the other one down.
Right. Right.
But that was it. That was as far as they were willing to take it. Neither of them was going to beat the other to death, no matter how pitched the battle, no matter how much adrenaline, no matter... There was always that control.
Well, I think the coolest, most telling part about that is that they're getting shot at by cops the entire time. So they're beating the crap out of each other while simultaneously pulling each other out of the line of fire the entire time. Like, they'll throw one to the ground, they'll keep it low if somebody gets up, you know, like so they don't want either side to get shot. They just want to prove that they're right by any means necessary, that their mythology is correct.
But you also get the sense early on, and this is something that comes into play very heavily later, is that Frank Castle is a badass from a half a mile away or right up in your face.
Right, right. Range yeah, doesn't you know, matter when you're printcasting.
He's not simply gunman. Mm-mm. Because anybody can be gunman, perhaps not as proficiently or as accurately, but I mean, all it takes is a gun to kill somebody with a gun.
That's true. That's true. But this is.
It takes a lot more to be able to survive hand-to-hand combat with a proficient enemy like Daredevil, who can pretty much anticipate, you know, practically anticipate your blows by listening to your bones move inside your body.
Right. I think what we learn by that, and we learn very early in this, is that we're not talking about an assassin. We're talking about a man with a personal vendetta, which is why he's willing to get so up close and personal if he needs to. Like, this is his world. This has become his being. And you know, it's that old argument that you hear with Batman, and you hear with Punisher, and you hear with any of your revenge characters, which is, if you find the people who shot your parents, if you find the people who killed your family, is that enough? Or will this continue? You know, and they do a really good job of portraying that in this, because at the end of the day, once you get, you know, once that first arc, once that first Frank Castle story arc is over, and they essentially lock him away, this is when I got concerned, because I had a fear that what they were going to do is put him in jail, and then we were going to move on to the Electra.
Yeah, this is going to be, you know, season one, part one, or season two, part one is going to be the Punisher story. Season two, part two is the Electra story.
Right. And speaking of, you know, just...
Of course, we like to call it the Electra Company.
Oh, man. Oh, did that have Bowser on it? Who'd that have on it? but talk about taking a story and using...
I'm thinking of Sha-na-na, by the way.
I am thinking of Sha-na-na. You are absolutely... I was young. I was very, very young. But
interesting enough, Morgan Freeman was easy writer. Was easy reader, rather, so...
but take... Using Daredevil as a Rosetta Stone to juxtapose two characters, then we bring in... And you knew it was going to happen... And they telegraphed it. And I'm not a big fan of the fact they telegraphed it, but Daredevil goes out after putting Punisher away for a night on the town with Karen, and they have a very intimate moment, and he doesn't want to ruin it, and so she doesn't come up, but he walks in and there sits Elektra in his apartment.
Yeah,
like, damn it. Okay, well, I guess we all should have seen that coming, but then we get introduced to Elektra. And what they do with Elektra is pretty brilliant, because what ends up happening is...
And I want to say, by the way, that the actress playing Elektra was absolutely perfect.
She was amazing.
She was exactly what Elektra should have looked like, sounded like. I mean, I like the fact that we're not going all in on costumes right off the bat, but...
Right, and I think that they did the costume enough.
They just did justice, yeah.
Yeah, they did enough. We didn't need the red sash whole shebang. We didn't need all that. We got what we needed. But in the comic, if you look at the Frank Miller stuff, they really brought it to screen very well that Elektra, her whole jam, the jam in her jelly, is to really be a monkey wrench in Matt Murdock's life for as long as she's known Matt Murdock. That's been her thing, is to, for some reason,
he speaks to her, and she just becomes this, it's this cat and mouse thing that she's got going on with him. She likes to, she's captivated him, so now she just likes to toy with him, because there's a little bit of that rich girl mentality, I think, that drives her.
Well, and also, I think that in her mind, there's a weird potential for him to be exactly the man that she thinks he should be inside of there. And she does everything she can to pull it away, because at the same time that she shows up, Murdock and Nelson get the case to defend Frank Castle in court for his crime.
Yes.
Which is a brilliant play, because that's how they brought it back around, where I thought for sure what was going to happen was we were going to forget Frank Castle existed until season 3 of Daredevil or something like
that.
But what really happened is, oh, wait, they're going to put him on trial in the show, and you're going to defend him, so he's not leaving. They've just now shifted that character to the courtroom aspect of the show, which was for about, what, the next six episodes?
He didn't ever really go away, which is a nice touch.
So that becomes the Law and Order aspect, which was, it for me, the figuring that mystery out was as interesting as the stuff with the hand.
Oh, yeah. And if one of the things I loved was the,
Ben Urich?
Yeah, Ben Urich's editor.
Oh, he's so good.
My God, you fall even more in love with the character.
Well, every time that they have the newspaper scenes, right? Because spoiler alert, Karen Page ends up essentially working for the newspaper through a series of events where she's doing research for the trial and discovering things and going to the paper to get information. She eventually just kind of falls into the role. But every scene that involves the newspaper, I just was like...
She winds up in her next unpaid job.
Right? She's just stumbling from job to job. She's like a Kardashian. but every one of those scenes, I'm like, did Aaron Sorkin write this? Like, because every one of those scenes, they do like the Aaron Sorkin walk and talk and the lines, and that editor is brilliant.
Yes.
He deserves like 5 awards. Give him some awards, please.
Just create awards.
For that guy. But yeah, so the courtroom scenes. Basically, they're trying to figure out why Frank Castle did it, and he's saying that, you know, there was this big, it was a setup, and his family was killed, and so what do they come to discover out of all that?
Yeah, what's interesting, though, is, you know, you have this sort of contention on Castle's part about the DA.
Right.
Who is inexplicably hell-bent to see him die.
Right.
And that, of course, piques Karen's interest. And peaks, you know, it becomes that sort of reversal of fortune, you know, or, you know why I take cases? Because I get pissed off.
Right.
And this is one of those things where they sort of fall into this because there's some underlying, there's more to the story, and nobody seems to want to address it. And, junior assistant there trying to make right because he's, potentially, in the, you know, he's ambitious enough to want to ride in on her coattails, but shrewd enough to know that if it all falls apart,
he's going down with the ship.
Yeah, he needs to be part of the solution, not the problem. And through him and through the secret files that apparently even the X-rays were copied, everybody gets a full set of murder prints with 8x10s with every file. It's like they took it with, like, you know, you have 2 prints for every roll you bring in.
I think you drop your murder prints. No, they're supposed to be there. Just don't. Okay, I'm gonna leave.
All right. Yeah, it's apparently part of any good case structure is to look at dead people all day.
Just all day, just dead people. Just the same dead people for days.
So, but they, as you get the X-ray, which is your precursor to the Punisher skull, because up at that point you've got your Punisher minus a key design element.
You've got Frank Castle up to this point.
That makes you feel like, you know, it's the Dolph Lundgren Punisher, where no, he's not going to have a costume. That's too much like a comic.
Right, right. He's just a crazy man with a bunch of guns.
Yeah. So, through the... This thing, I think the thing that I love most about the Marvel television is they take full advantage of being a television show and having the time to build character. And what it brilliantly does is give you a supporting cast that outshines the supporting cast on any television drama out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Because you see Karen Foggy grow exponentially. Karen's down to the point where she's practically fearless.
Right.
You know, Daredevil's tagline is the man without fear, but it's really Karen who's just... she's got bigger balls than Jimmy Big Balls.
and that's saying something.
Yes.
but yeah, I mean, they, and this whole time, So the biggest case in Hell's Kitchen history, right?
Yes.
The
New York history, probably.
Yeah. You've got this giant, you know, this guy that went on this murder spree, killed hundreds of people, probably. Yeah. If you want to get down to it, probably killed hundreds of people. Is standing trial. This small attorney's office, you know, is defending him because they fought to get the case. And all of a sudden, Matt's not around anymore because Elektra showed up to screw up his world because she's got a problem with, which they set up brilliantly last season, which is the power vacuum that's left when you put Kingpin away. What happens? Yeah. All of a sudden, you know, everybody comes in jostling and jockeying for power. Well, we find out that one of the people he put away never really went away.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be the Hand, which, trust me, no one was more excited for some ninja action than me. I was so excited. Like, ninja action? I was actually mad for, like, the first five episodes. There weren't any ninjas in it yet.
Where are my damn ninjas? I was promised ninjas.
I was promised ninjas. There is a lack of ninjas. But, yeah, so Daredevil's out at night trying to, because Elektra comes in, says, I need to go to Roxxon, which, by the way, Roxxon, pretty cool.
Yeah.
I need to go to Roxxon headquarters. You know, my business, my father's business has some dealings, and I want to find out what's going on. So I'm going to, you know, I need you to escort me. I'm calling in a favor. I need you to escort me. So they go there. You know, she steals a bunch of information, comes back. You know, they show up at her penthouse suite, and she essentially says, oh, yeah, those people? Yeah, that was the Hand. So get ready. Get ready, because they're coming right now. Like, Daredevil's like, oh, wait, yeah, they are. Damn it, they're like four blocks away, and one of them's wearing a sole that's slightly worn down on his right shoe. But this is when this is when the fighting gets good, because this is when it gets all weird.
But also one of the things that
excuse me,
as brilliant as the fighting is, the not fighting is almost as brilliant sometimes.
Yeah.
Like when they're trying to sneak out of the building, or sneak in and sneak out with this with the ledger that inexplicably is in Chinese, or rather in Japanese, but reads reads left to
left,
right.
Reads left to right. That's the code. They were trying to break the code.
Oh, I see. That's what the problem was.
That really stymies anybody who reads Japanese. Like, Americans are like, oh, I know what this says.
It's like, what is this? It's like, I killed Paul? I don't understand.
It's like, oh, it's in code. No, it's really not. It's just in English.
Yeah, like, it's the damnedest thing. Who knew that you write it simultaneously in both languages?
It's insidious, that code. But
it's
subtle. That was cool. That was really cool.
Yeah, but just pretending to be a couple of drunks one floor down was not convincing, I don't think, enough. But I guess when you're confronted with a blind guy and you're just a paid lackey,
yeah, you kind of let let that go. You don't want to offend.
Yeah.
But no, like,
I mean, they obviously didn't know what Elektra looked like. So,
well, and then we find out, and this is the cool stuff for me. Like, I really like the courtroom drama stuff. I really do. But then when Stick shows up, fuck Stick, and you find out that Elektra's been working with Stick the whole time, and their entire relationship when he was in college and on was a setup to try to bring him in to the family. Like, come on, that's so good. That's so good.
It kind of draws everything together and gives you a good explanation where you don't have the spoiled rich girl who apparently was really into martial arts. You have a good reason for her to be this, you know, martial powerhouse.
Right.
Because she's just another of Stick's little minions.
Right. Or is she? Or is she? But at the same time, this is happening. This is really hard to follow. I know. Watch the show. Back in the courtroom, we meet Frank Castle's superior officer from the military. Speaking
Lance
of
Brown gets work.
God, I was going to say, speaking of supporting cast, anytime Clancy Brown is working, I'm happy.
Oh, me too. Buckaroo Banzai forward. I'm a happy man.
But he's talking about what a great guy Frank Castle is, and he's there as a character witness, and he's talking about how he, you know, he lost his arm because of hubris, and Frank Castle saved his life, and how awesome it is, and you know, it really
comes a monkey wrench against the state's case.
Yes, yeah.
The city's case.
And in the meantime, Matt is just not showing up to court, just out with Elektra all night, just leaving, in doing so, giving us a brilliant look into how good Foggy Nelson is at his job, which
yes.
allowing him to get out from Matt's shadow.
Yeah, and I think that Foggy was always a great lawyer, and Matt recognized that, and Foggy didn't.
Right.
Foggy always allowed himself to be in Matt's shadow to the point where even when he's shining, he's worried, and all he can think of is, where's Matt? I shouldn't be doing this. And the other thing was, it also brilliantly showed how untenable it is to run a law practice and be a superhero.
Right, and be a nightborn vigilante.
Yeah, it didn't ignore that.
Which I think was cool.
If you look in comics, the most effective superheroes are either filthy rich or dirt poor, because those are the only two people who don't have to be somewhere.
Which, by the way, I can't wait for D-Man Season 1.
Oh, that's going to... They're eyeing that already.
I can't wait. talk about your street-level heroes.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, and that was one of the things that the show did very well, was show how, like you said, show how almost impossible it is to have a day job and fight crime at night. And
see, I need to interject here real quick with D-Man.
Yes, please
do. I think because we've established now the metahuman.
Right.
Especially with Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and such. It would not be a far stretch to have a metahuman be like, you know, a war vet or somebody else who, you know, had great potential at one time and snapped and winds up on the street with schizophrenia and
oh, sure.
happens to be superpowered.
Yeah, I know, absolutely.
I could actually see D-Man making sense. I mean, not on the level to which he's invited to join the Avengers, but certainly it would make sense to have a character that, you know, just is dismissed as being just another street bum, but he also happens to have superpowers and can crack your head open like a grape.
Right, and there's some sort of you know, like homeless cabal that he has to overthrow and it would work. I'm yeah. saying it would work. And I'm not being tongue-in-cheek here. I really believe...
I think that they could weave D-Man into the television verse, and I would actually be happy if they did right. But yeah, back to the courtroom drama, I think they let these characters really shine and do something more than just sort of be there. It's... A comparator would be, I haven't watched much of it.
Yes.
But The Flash.
Right.
Where, you know, the characters are just kind of cookie cutter. The supporting characters are almost like archetype. You know, you have to have this particular type of character, this particular type of character, this
right.
particular type. And you see that all the time in television superhero.
Right.
It's like a man, you know, it's a demand. You have to have these.
You got your pretty girl. You've got your nerd guy. You've got
yeah.
your, you know, best
with,
friend. You've got
with
your,
this,
yeah.
They're drawing from the comics and extrapolating on these characters and making them into viable and valuable parts of the story.
More, in a lot of cases, as much or more so than your lead character.
Yeah.
Because there was and one issue or one episode, and I'll have to go back and actually do the research to find out, you know, how true this is, my actual numbers. But I'm pretty sure that the one with Clancy Brown in it, that Foggy and Karen appear more than Matt in that episode.
I think you may be right.
So you have a show called Daredevil, and in one whole issue of the show, which only gets 13 episodes a year.
Yeah.
You have one of those episodes dedicated solely to your supporting cast, which is a pretty big jump, which is a pretty big deal.
Absolutely, because you don't see that sort of thing. It's rather unprecedented.
Right. So, but in this same series of events, we see the backhanded machinations of something happening, where it causes Frank Castle to throw his court case.
Yeah.
And we don't know why at this point. We just know that he throws his court case, goes crazy, says, I'll kill y'all, I'll kill everybody, I'm a crazy mother, blah, blah. Like, just you know, Gene Simmons, blah, just screaming and yelling. And nobody knows why he's doing it. Paige and Nelson are just like, what? What
yeah.
just happened? And he's thrown in jail. He's thrown in jail, and I think Cole should speak to that next part, because I think that had to thrill him more than anything on earth.
That really becomes the whole Rorschach. I'm not stuck in here with you. You're stuck in here with me.
Right.
Kind of thing. I mean, he is exactly where he wants to be because he can inflict the most potential damage to somebody who deserves it.
Right. It's like a stocked pond in there. That's what it is. It's like a stock pond, and he's got dynamite.
But what also happens here is it's a wonderful vehicle, a very subtle vehicle to bring you back to Wilson Fisk.
Which I thought was brilliant.
I mean, they could have just crowbarred him back into the plot line. But this ties the whole thing together in that in Castle, Fisk finds exactly what he needs because he needs pawns.
And there's
only so far he can go with his resources to build himself as sort of like the neighboring block top dog.
And I think what may have been the best episode of the season was the episode that we didn't think we were going to get revolving around Wilson Fisk in jail.
Yes.
That was so brilliant because I think he legitimately went in, and they portrayed it this way, that he legitimately went in with the purpose, the sole purpose of doing his time. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to go in, I'm going to do, but he's so wired for being a kingpin that he cannot stand for someone to have more control and more power than he does. So he starts building an army in jail and power and influence. And
does it in the most brilliant possible way.
Right.
It's like, you know, you're stuck here, but there are people in your life that I can benefit from afar that will do you every bit more good than anything, you know. An extra case of cigarettes isn't going to do you as much good as this in the long run.
Right. But by the end of that episode, you see that he does have the power to manipulate the system into getting Frank Castle, into holding court, you know, for Frank Castle and saying, I've got a problem. If you solve my problem, I'll solve yours, essentially.
Exactly.
And there was a brilliant scene in the end of that episode where Fisk is there and Castle's there and Castle's chained up on the thing and you know the last scene is don't think that this is a this is a partnership of happenstance. If I see you outside of here, I'm going to kill you. Like this is going to happen. You will die. Like, and then he walks out the door. Like what the heck? Like. It was. God,
and I think
so good.
It's one of those things where Fisk is like very comfortable with that because he's like, of course you would.
Right. I'm, and it's also the first time we get to hear him refer to himself as the Kingpin.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool because where else would he do it? You know,
exactly.
Where else would you refer to yourself as the Kingpin if not in jail? It was.
And of course, the fight scene in the jail. You know,
oh my!
Just a single shiv.
Oh.
Is all that's necessary. And even then wasn't necessarily 100% necessary to make just lay waste to an entire army of the incarcerated.
Well, and again, it's that single shot down the hallway, brutal, up close, personal, visceral fight scene that the show's become known for. And
this is where you really get to see the brutality potential. That you see how much he's pulling his punches previously with Daredevil,
right? And just a sense of relentlessness, you know,
yes.
Just a sense of
single-minded purposefulness.
God.
That comes into play even later in that wonderful. I can't remember the name of the movie with Denzel Washington. That is a little nod to that with the scene in the diner.
Oh God! It was Training Day.
There was a movie where he would like set his watch and time himself when
Why can't I think of? Yes,
yeah.
I know when he's catching the bullet like that. Yeah, that no. God, that diner scene was so good.
Yeah, it was very reminiscent of that. It's like, you know, okay, here comes some guys. It's going to get ugly.
He's just sitting there talking to her. He's like, all right, I'm going to need you to get up and go into the back and hide under the largest steel thing you can find.
Yeah, get everybody herded into the back because this is going to get ugly here.
It's so good. So good. But in the meantime, while all this is happening, we find out that, remember Black Sky from last season?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know that kid they were smuggling in with that stick episode? Yeah, that one? Yeah, Elektra's Black Sky. We just find that out. It's just like, hey, here you go.
This is the point where things fall apart for me.
Oh, really? Okay.
In so much as from the introduction of Stick, there's this impending war that's your big bad looming in the distance. And then, you know, Stick resurfaces and the Black Sky, which is crucial to this great war, he's had under his wing all this time, to the consternation of his allies. And the whole idea behind the Black Sky and this whole war, it seems like the most ineffectively fought war, because everybody, he's got like four adults and two former children, one of whom is the enemy itself.
Right.
And, you know, ultimately the big war doesn't really come off as much of anything but a shitload of ninjas.
Well, I mean, first of all, Shitload of Ninjas is the name of my next album.
As much as I enjoy buckets of ninjas as much as the next guy, but it just seemed like there was a lot of build to a war that, you know, you had the inexplicable Vado blood.
Right, right.
And this mysterious war that seemed to come to nothing.
Well, see, and I don't think that they did, and I'm going to defend this in a way that I'm not going to defend Batman versus Superman when we talk about it, because I can pick and choose my battles, because I'm a nerd. I think that what we saw, first of all, I don't think, and Black Sky really isn't a comic book thing as much as the TV show. But yeah. My understanding is that Black Sky can be, it isn't just one, right?
Like, yeah, because I mean, he obviously went way out of his way to kill the one that was still a kid.
Right. So I also don't think that, I also don't think this was the war. I think this was a battle in the war. I think that the war is still coming, and I think that's what we're going to get. I personally, if I'm going to speculate, I think that's what we're going to get in the Defenders. I think that the hand is going to come to play a bigger part.
That's where we're building toward.
Right. I think that this was the opening battle of that the visible war that we get to see was this leads, if we can get Elektra on our side, we will have the ultimate weapon. We win the war without, because I think even at one point Stick says, now that they have this, they win the war without ever firing a shot or something like that.
Yeah.
But they can't. But Matt Murdock's goodness won't let Elektra. You know, I believe in you, Keanu Reeves. Won't let her turn to the dark side. So they lost that battle. They lost that chess piece in their grand coming war. But we also find out in this, which is really cool, that the higher ranking hand have mastered death, which is definitely in the comic books that they don't die.
Yeah, and you see that with the pre-autopsy dead ninja.
Oh, that was a cool scene. I forgot about that. Where.
And that was another thing that was kind of cool, is that there was a subtle acknowledgement, twice at least, of Jessica Jones.
There were, absolutely.
First being Nurse Ratchet there.
The Night Nurse.
Night Nurse, they're referring back to having met Luke Cage.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, getting Carrie Ann Moss to come and reprise her role later to hire Foggy Nelson to her firm.
And then Foggy Nelson's girlfriend, well, not girlfriend, girlfriend, not girlfriend,
yeah,
mentioning that, you know, the firm that she works for has...
interests, yes, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, they did they're starting to do a really good job of folding,
interweaving. They're empire building, basically, which is really nice.
So
the biggest concern is, even though they're all... Had this been normal television, even if they're all the same network,
right?
It's very difficult to get anybody to understand that, you know, you need to have that synergy. You need to build this universe so that, you know, when you get Luke Cage, you've established Jessica Jones in his life as well as in this universe.
Exactly.
And she's going to be carrying the baggage of the Purple Man.
Oh, so creepy. Yeah. David Tennant did such a good job. But so we end on a rooftop in a big fight between Nobu and Nobu and the Hand versus Elektra and Daredevil. Just a throwdown, knockdown, drag out fight. That's ended because in the meantime, in the meantime, Frank Castle escapes and goes after teams up with Karen Page essentially, and they kind of go on a Thelma and Louise style mission to figure out because they figure out that there's one a guy behind it all, essentially, but they can't figure out who it is. It's a guy named the Blacksmith, but we're assuming at this point that Frank Castle is dead, but he's not dead, so she shows up to get any further information from good old Clancy Brown.
That's right.
Oh, man. He did such a good job.
Oh, he did.
And you know, in the meantime, Frank Castle explodes a ship that he thinks that the Blacksmith's on. Everybody thinks he's dead because the ship exploded, but I don't know. You can explain it better than I do because I get really excited.
No, you're on the right track there because, you know, in his quest for vengeance, his quest to track down the elusive Blacksmith, he finds obvious ship O crime. You know, they're up to no good. So they deserve to die or get blowed up.
The old ship of crime.
Yeah. And, you're left with, at this point, you really get this wonderful sense of how brilliantly they've made the Punisher a sympathetic character.
Right.
Through the vehicle of Karen Page, who should have, you know...
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
He was trying to kill her, or as far as she knew, she was definitely trying to kill the person they were trying to defend, the lowlife he was after.
Right.
And then he tells her later, you know, for what it's worth, you were safe. You know, there was no way in hell he was going to harm her to get to him.
Right. You're an innocent, and she's like, maybe not so much, season three, but he's like, you're innocent enough that I'm not gonna do anything to you.
Well, you're certainly not on his dance card.
Exactly, exactly.
A lot of people were.
You didn't swipe right on organized crime Tinder for that one.
You're not a Hell's, you're not a biker, an Irish, or
a cartel member.
A cartel, that was right. Yeah, the cartel. So you're pretty much safe for now until the next agenda lottery begins. But at this point, you know, she's genuinely concerned that he may have met his end.
Right, right. And so at this point, she's just trying to wrap things up.
Plus, at that point, you also have the war on the Punisher escalates because of the old chestnut of discrediting your enemy by
right
by robbing the bank in a Spider-Man suit or
oh, that's right, I forgot about that.
And that was a really brilliant thing, like where the DA's running scared and turning to Nelson and Murdoch for help because she really is feeling the heat from the Punisher and has to come clean. And there was a really clever thing that was done in the costume that I pointed out to Catherine. And I don't know if many people caught this.
Okay.
But when they meet in her office, she's wearing a hooded sweatshirt of her alma mater.
Right.
Look at from season one straight through season two. What's the one thing you wear when you want to disguise yourself?
A
hoodie.
Right. A hooded sweatshirt. Right.
Yeah. So it subtly suggests this is how they smuggled her into her office, for safety's sake.
Nice.
Because at first glance, I'm thinking, okay, you know, it's casual day because she's kind of, rattled. She didn't have time to even shower, much less put on a power suit.
Right.
And then it suddenly occurred to me, wait a minute, that is brilliant. Everybody who's trying to go incognito wears a hoodie.
Right. So they just that's how they got her in under the radar.
Yeah, they basically, taking a page from Shakespeare with Henry V, all you don a hoodie and no one can tell you're the king.
That's right. But yeah, so
people don't realize Shakespeare invented the hoodie.
So Frank Castle is assumed dead after he goes to the ship of crime and just blowed it up, but not before being caught by a bunch of the blacksmith's men, including bassist for Ultron Cafe, Blondie McSweedman. this guy's the most Nordic guy I've ever seen.
Although we think we blow you, we see you over on the boat there. We got the RPG, and we going to.
But yes. But Blondie McSweedman is there. He ties everything together. He dies. Karen Page sees him. Goes to Clancy Brown's house because she's just trying to write a story about Frank Castle's life to make him more sympathetic and not have him die a murderer.
To get everyone to see him through her eyes.
Right.
Since he's dead and can never tell his tale.
She's talking to him about what a good guy Frank Castle is and how he nobody knew him. He used to tell jokes. He used to sing songs, blah, blah, blah. She turns around on the wall, sees a picture from their deployment in Afghanistan, and there's Clancy Brown, Frank Castle, and Blondie McSween.
Yes, indeed.
And she's like, oh, shit! And then he realizes it, and he's like, oh, shit. And then he goes into his megalomaniac arch-villain speech.
He's also come to the realization nobody knows he's there, that she's there.
Right. Nobody knows she's there. He tells he gives his spiel about why he's orchestrated all of this, including Frank Castle's demise, because Frank Castle didn't want in on his criminal organization.
That's right. He wouldn't play ball.
But he was screwed in the military, so he decided to take it back as a civilian and form this giant criminal organization to push all these drugs and make all this money. And now we're going to take a car ride. The old car ride, Karen.
Oh, and here was where it really gets fun, because, you know, you're half expecting the laser pinpoint or...
Oh, my God, you're right? Like you're waiting for it.
You know, you're waiting, because there were several shots of the headlights, and you're just waiting for, you know, all of a sudden here's Frank Castle in the middle of the street with a... say hello to my little friend, M16.
Well, the cool thing was there was this little tell, which at one point, you know, when they're driving around, when Karen Page is driving Frank Castle around, Frank Castle reaches in her glove box and pulls out a tape, and I can't remember. Do you remember what song it was?
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yes, I can't remember the song either now, but yes, that the tape was back in.
And he puts the tape in, and he's singing along. He's like, I really like this song. My daughters like this song. Blah, blah, blah. I'm Frank Castle. I'm humanizing myself. Yeah, I've got 17 guns strapped to me right now, but I really like some disco. She makes him take the tape out and put it away. They drive around for a while, then you kind of forget about it. Well, then
yes, when it's in back in the
yes,
when she starts the car and it's playing,
and you're like, oh, he's here. Like, so now okay, you're waiting on it.
So yeah, you're anticipating somewhere. You know, either he's going to hop out of the back seat and slit the guy's throat, or. And what was brilliant is it just, you know, bam!
Yeah, no, I was not expecting a broadside T-bone of a car just out of nowhere. Like, because, like you said, you're waiting for him to be on the road, you're waiting for the red dot, you're waiting for him to pop up with a garrote from the back seat, you're waiting for anything but, you know, a blunt instrument. Because he's surgical. So, this is not a surgical strike for Frank.
Now, this is the I want answers.
Right. This is vengeance.
I want to cripple you enough that I can interrogate you or make you suffer like I have.
Right. This is vengeance. Yeah. No. That's exactly what it is. You need to feel what I've felt for the past, you know, 10 years or however long it's been, 5 years. You need to feel what I've felt. So Karen's, you know, imploring him to not murder, you know, because she wakes up, you know, after being broadsided, she's fine, because she puts on her seatbelt. As soon as she hears the music, as soon as she hears the song, she reaches over and puts on her seatbelt, which I was like, okay, I like this. I don't usually like telegraphing, but this is a good telegraph. This is cool.
Well, it telegraphs to the audience, but what's brilliant is, you know, he's not in the wiser. Why wouldn't she have a stupid girl tape in her.
Right. He has no idea what's coming, and we do. We're let in on the joke. And he's So Karen comes to, finds him dragging the Clancy Brown, otherwise known as the blacksmith, you know, over to some weird shack in the woods, which nobody needs to go to Killshed County with the Punisher, all right?
Yeah, you don't want to have the Killshed handy.
Why would you, if you know this guy exists, take your Killshed out. Be like, I'm going to end up here. Have the foresight to realize that you're going
to
end up in a kill shed.
You want to come and find like the little concrete foundation. It's like, damn it,
There was a kill.
Why'd
I know.
You make this so hard on me.
I know. I have a spider sense for kill sheds. I knew there was a kill shed here at one point. But drags him into the kill shed, slams the door. Karen, you know, defeated because she's lost her project. She's failed in her mission to humanize Frank Castle to himself. And then Frank interrogates him, finds out why, you know, why he did what he did, because he wouldn't play ball, because he wouldn't get in on the organization. So, you know, he had to send a message, you know, his family got killed in this tri-gang shootout. It's like a slam dunk competition for mobsters. And so I thought it was brilliant that as soon as Frank got the answer that he wanted, you know, he did, because Clancy Brown was continuing with his megalomania diatribe. Like, oh, you thought that, yeah, and all of a sudden Frank just pulls out a gun and puts one through his brain.
Yeah.
Just right in the middle of a sentence, just kadoosh, you're dead.
Yeah, I don't need to hear the rest of the story.
And then, the kill shed turns into Nakatomi Tower Die Hard, where you like knock off a, like, I forget how, but something, he bumps into something and something moves.
Triggers,
and he's like, oh, something's back here. Opens it up.
Behind the 3-in-1 oil here.
Opens it up to what I can only describe as Jack Palance's pool house back there.
Like that hidden panel in the pawn shop behind the, in Commando, you know, where if you know the right things to say, they'll admit that it's there.
Right.
And Men in Black, you know.
No, you're exactly right.
Let me see the imports.
But he opens up this secret room behind the room in the kill shed, and it's just, it's blacksmith's armory. Just guns for days in there. Just every type imaginable, and the flak jacket, the bulletproof vest that oddly has already built into it kind of the imagery of the skull.
Yeah, it's rather artfully.
Right. And so he goes home one last time to say goodbye to his family, goes into his shed. Apparently Michael's was closed. Couldn't get the puffy paint that he wanted to make his Punisher. Breaks out the spray paint, sprints up the skull, and then officially becomes the Punisher at that point.
That when he's overwhelmed by the fumes.
Yeah, he should have opened a window.
Yeah.
And you got to ventilate that. Is it weird that I kind of thought that?
He's got the flashlight in his mouth, so he's breathing heavily through his nose. He's collecting in his nasal cavity. I mean, if he shined a light up at his nose, inside his nasal cavity, he'd be all white from the paint that got up in there.
And he says, oh, what a lovely day. And then, no, but is it weird that I thought that in the show? I was like, man, all he's doing is breathe. How's that not getting all over everything? How's that not, like, he doesn't have this stenciled out. Like, he's just spray painting. Like, this is not.
He probably learned that from those guys that are, like, you know, if you're going through major cities at night and tourist areas. And they're out there with like 20 spray paint cans and a lighter.
It's a skill he picked up.
Yeah, he just probably watched the street guy out there, you know.
So yeah, then we end up on the rooftop for the big final battle royale with Nobu and the Hand Army versus Elektra and Daredevil going at it full ninja style, which is the way I get my fries at In-N-Out. Just going at
it's
it.
It's on the secret menu.
And we have a really interesting, why don't you wrap it up there? Because you'll do more a more eloquent job than I do.
Well, I was thinking, you know, in that final battle where it's just ninjas a-go-go, and it's just this perpetual, steady stream of guys with swords and bow and arrow and
chains and
chains, yeah, and things, you know, everything from the walls of the Cobra Kai dojo.
That's right. Looted that place.
Right. So they're all, you know, charging and coming and taking their licks, and you know, it's starting to wear your combatants down.
It was wearing me down, and I was just watching the thing.
And all I could think of was, you know, this would be a great time for some one shot, one kill, and then bam, there it is.
Well, that's not before we get the bullseye moment.
Oh, that's right.
Where Elektra gets run through with her own size, but it's not Bullseye. It's Nobu, the hand leader, runs her through with her own size after a big ass fight scene. Which, you know, I didn't. Here's the thing, Kingpin, I invested pretty heavily in, right? Yeah. Punisher, I invested. Frank Castle, I invested just as heavily in Frank Castle as I did in Kingpin. I did not have that same level of investment for Elektra. I just didn't.
She was a little harder to latch on to, I think, because of the fact that by her nature, she had this sort of inexplicable waffling.
Yeah.
You know, she seems to wax and wane between some sort of playful belligerence and great determination. And once she's confronted with the truth of her origins, of her life, that she almost falls into that tired chestnut of this sort of almost meaningless mental struggle.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think in a lot of ways, Elektra did not get the chance to really shine at full because there was so much else going on. But also, you know, her character was... I loved the portrayal and everything. And some of the stuff where, like, you know, back when she's confronted with the guy that's come to kill her at the airport.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of things like that were just brilliantly played, but there were also areas where you just were never allowed to latch onto her in the way you have other characters.
Well, I think that she suffered because what we've talked about all night has been the fact that this show does a really good job of developing its characters. They developed Frank Castle, they developed Foggy, they developed Karen, they developed Matt, you know, Kingpin, they've developed... Elektra to me was more of a plot device than a character that they felt needed to be developed. And yeah. I think that she suffered greatly for that in the show. I think she could have been a compelling character. I just don't think they gave her the shot, maybe yet, that she deserves to have.
Yeah, they gave you a little bit of backstory, a little bit of insight into her character.
Right.
But, you know, there frankly isn't time in the midst of all that to give her the full shake, because this was really more Frank Castle's story, and perhaps Elektra's story is yet to be told, because, you know, she did wind up in the old Chinese janitor drum.
Yes, she did. The low pan waiting room.
The ancient Chinese secret urn. It's just full of Calgon.
Well, she's going to look great. That's the hand secret to defeating death is Calgon.
Yeah, take you away.
So that's pretty much this season. Is it ends on Elektra's death, Frank Castle's redemption, at least Frank Castle's redemption in the eyes that he achieved the justice that he wanted, and then went on to help Matt Murdock defeat Nobu, because he one shot one killed him after he got done killing Elektra. And then you see him standing up there with his Punisher chest plate and his gun over his shoulder, just looking Punishery.
Yeah,
just looking mean.
It was like Punisher movie poster.
It was definitely that, and I was honestly was pretty happy about it. I was like, "That's cool."
And then the little line, you know, "See you around, Red."
Yep, see you around, Red.
And of course, they brilliantly cast using Shane from Walking Dead.
I didn't like Shane in Walking Dead. I really liked him as the Punisher.
Oh, when I heard he was cast, oh my God, he is perfect. Because as Shane in The Walking Dead, he was cutting his teeth for this role.
That's true.
The other thing is we're left with Kingpin still in jail,
mm-hmm.
but very much in control. Two amazing things happen. One is the confrontation with Matt Murdock. Here he is.
Oh my God.
His archenemy doesn't even know it.
Oh.
And him, you know, roundly beating Matt Murdock.
But, because Matt Murdock goes in to interrogate him. after he finds out that Frank Castle was sent to the same prison as Kingpin.
Yeah.
Because Matt's no dummy. Matt knows this was orchestrated. But at the end of that confrontation, when Matt's trying to interrogate him, it ends up being an interrogation on Matt.
Yeah. And you get to see Kingpin truly comes of his own, even more so in that one scene.
Yes.
Than in the entire first season.
God, you reminded me of that because there's one line in that scene. Do you know what I'm talking about? At the very end.
Oh yeah.
He says he's talking to he's talking to his lawyer on the phone, and he says, "Get me all the files on Matt Murdock. There's something I think I missed." So all of a sudden, oh shit! Does he know? Does he figured it out?
Yeah.
Like, oh god, no, man. Like, which is the setup for season three. What they're talking about for season three is the entire story arc where Kingpin and Kingpin tells him this in prison. I will figure out who you are. I will figure out who you love, and I will destroy your life. I'm going to destroy you. And that's what. There's a huge story arc in a Frank Miller story arc in Daredevil where that's exactly what Kingpin does is figure out that Daredevil is Matt Murdock and systematically destroy his life just point by point as Daredevil and as Matt Murdock just take him completely apart, which I'm wondering if that's where they're going with next season.
I would not be surprised. I mean, it was just a treat to have
so good
D'Onofrio back. And, you know, you're left with a more fully realized Daredevil, because now he's also Gladiator guy's given him his...
Oh, I was going to say, we didn't even talk about
the trademark baton is finally... And it was one of the things going into that season, I wish they would, you know, weren't afraid to do that. It's like, no, they weren't afraid to do that. They were shrewd about doing it.
Right. Well, I was going to say, that's the one character that we haven't talked about yet this season is his baton, his brilliant baton.
Oh, exactly. And getting to see, the future Gladiator character.
Oh.
Where he's, like, showing off his body armor, and it's basically the chest piece.
And he's got all of the diagrams there, too, on the table. Oh, so good.
Well, that one point where he's startled, he picks up the saw blade.
Oh, how good is this show? Like, just for real. Just, like, we haven't even...
There's so many little treats in there. If you're in the know, it's a wonderful treat, but you don't have to be.
Right.
And then he picks up a saw blade, that would be the first thing he had at hand.
Exactly.
Against an intruder. But if you know, you're like, oh, bless you. And I don't know if this was prevalent last season or not, but I did very much notice a movie poster on his wall showing a Gladiator.
Yes, I don't know if I saw it this season, but the other line I really liked from him, and I'm real glad that they brought him back. But the other line that he gave him when he was outfitting Elektra with her resilient costume was, you know, I had this for my wife. I was saving this for my wife for protection, but I guess you can use it. That line, like just. And when he gives him the billy club and he says, you know, he's like, I can't take this. He's like, yeah, you're protecting the city. Let me protect you. Like, it was so cool. Like, that character, I think that character might be the unsung character of the entire show.
I think so, absolutely, because he, it's, well, that line we talked about way back when we did the first season, where, you know, he's being referred to as half an idiot.
Right.
And Fist is the other half that counts.
That's right. And they did make him less an idiot in this. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
They smarted him up some. They didn't make him like an oaf.
That it's a subtle way of suggesting that absent that the presence of Kingpin, of Fisk, he's a lot more comfortable with himself.
That's a... That he isn't living in fear.
Yeah, he isn't under the thumb of.
God, that's really good. That's a really good analysis, Cole. I like that.
I think he's feeling a lot more confident, and that's why he also is so reverent to Daredevil. It's like, you know, you unshackled me, so
right.
You know, what can't I do for you?
So what's your takeaway from this season, because we need to start wrapping it up. So
yeah, we're
a little long, but it was going to. It was bound to happen.
That they've proven they can take the field again, follow a brilliant start and not lose much, if any, momentum. The casting continues to remain impeccable.
Right.
The characterization, for the most part, remains unprecedented. And it between this and having this book end with Jessica Jones gives me so much promise for... I mean, they're setting the bar so high while simultaneously saying we're inviting ourselves, we're challenging ourselves, we're going to be worthy of the challenges we've set. Because there is this sort of underlying editorial mandate to be that good. And so you're taking these characters that on the surface you thought, what are you going to do with that? It very much reminds me of Thor, you know, when that was, you know, Thor was an inevitability so they could build toward the Avengers. Like, how are you going to get me interested in a Thor movie? Oh, okay.
That's how you do it. That's how you do it. And I think that that's that's my takeaway from this, is that sentence, that's how you do it. Because, you know, we were talking before the show that not that this show is an evergreen, but, you know, we were talking about the Batman versus Superman movie that came out recently. And, you know, if you want to know how to do it, look at Daredevil. If you want to know, you know, if there's certain things about Arrow and Flash where I'm like, man, why can't they all just be Daredevil?
Yes, exactly.
You know, learn from this. Don't fight it. Learn from it.
I think a lot of it is what this film, what this show does is presupposes the audience is smart enough to get it. Warner's is still so terrified of the idea that people will embrace a superhero that isn't Batman or Superman.
Right.
And so they're terrified of costume elements, they're terrified of plot elements, they're terrified of doing anything that would tie it into a comic. And yet, they're ignoring the fact that their own comics, you know, the source material, to this day still sells proficiently.
Right. We talked about it last issue. Like, they're getting ready to launch 2 a month, and they're presupposing that they're going to sell more that way. But yet, you can't base a movie on that idea.
Yeah, exactly. I just keep hoping that eventually Warner will wake up, and I don't know if they're just afraid they don't want to have comparisons drawn, they want to be their own man, but you can still be your own thing and tell compelling stories. The idea isn't, don't just tell superhero stories, tell good stories that happen to be about superheroes.
And this is how you do it. And this is how you do it. All right.
It makes me excited about the universe that they're building.
Oh, it's so
and
good.
The fact that I just recently read they're now eyeing a series for She-Hulk, Bullseye, Elektra, and one other character that escapes me.
Well, I mean, we...
And that's on top of everything else that's already been announced officially. Iron Fist, Luke Cage, The Defenders.
Right, and with the addition of Shang-Chi in Iron Fist, which is still almost to the point where it's not a rumor anymore. Almost to the point where that's actually going to happen.
I read the other day that they cast Colleen Wing.
They did, yes.
They're also understanding that these... What made some of these things timeless is the fact that they had supporting cast that were worthwhile.
The other part of this, and I think that this is my takeaway, is that when you bring people in to make a show that not only understand the source material, but are willing to have fun with it.
Yeah.
You know, like, that are in it to have fun with the source material. And it's obvious that there's a reverence there, but there's also, it's a playground. It's a chance for them to play with these giant action figures, these autonomous action figures that they've always wanted to do this with. You have brilliant storytellers, and you give them a sandbox, and you say, here's your source material, go play, and they will, and they'll make brilliant movies. Look at the Russo brothers, you know, Ultron, Age of Ultron notwithstanding, but like, look at your Captain America, Winter Soldier, that's a Jason Bourne superhero movie, you know, you give these guys that came up in this world with comic books, with action figures, with toys that have the impetus and the talent to actually make what you've always wanted to make and can't. It's going to be fun. It's going to be enjoyable. So I think that's my takeaway. It couldn't have been Daredevil. I don't know if it can be a better show. Like I don't.
There's very little room for improvement, if any.
I don't want to test it. Let's put it that way. Like, let's just let it be what it is. Let's not test it. But other than that, so why don't you wrap us up and we'll get out of here for the night.
Absolutely. This is, of course, Hey Kids Comics, coming to you from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. And we can I'm still putting out the odd tweet there on at the Jedi Cole U if you want to follow us there. You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. We're really encouraging people to write in and ask us questions about comics or the comic industry or any number of things, because we'd love to do another Hey Kids Comics Presents, I believe was the was the title. And we are about to launch a brand new story arc.
We are, next week.
Next week.
Which I'm very excited about.
The comic book Capers begins in just a week from today. And in the meantime, Andy just got back from a comic convention.
I did. I just got back from Jim City Comic Con. It was fantastic. A whole lot of fun. Got to see a bunch of our... Dayton, Ohio represents artists and writers that I haven't got to see in a long time, and I'm really hoping that I can bring them on the show and do some stuff in the near future, because they're great guys and gals, and I really want them to get some airtime here, so we're gonna work on that.
Excellent. So if you're keen on conventions that are in Texas anyway, I can't help the rest of the nation. There's only one me, but. For our Texas friends, we have the Convention Awareness Project Texas, which is a very big part of the JCU. And CAP Texas is bringing you listings of conventions all over the Lone Star State all year long, so you don't miss a show, because you can't go if you don't know. You can check that out at cap-tx.info.
That's right. Now, we're going to get out of here, but next week we're coming to you with a big story arc, lots of reference materials, lots of research. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're hoping to get some guests on there. We're doing true life crime in comic books. So things about the famous court cases, actual like comic book thefts. We've got one on this one story in particular that I'm not going to tip our hand on, but I didn't know it existed until I started reading it. It reads like a 48 hours story.
Oh, it does.
So brilliant. So without further ado, we're going to take off for the night. It's late. We got to go back and watch some more, rewatch Daredevil, see what we missed. I implore you guys, go watch Daredevil. It's so much fun. Watch it again if you haven't. It's great. So with all that being said, say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week for the first issue of the Comic Capers.
To see it tonight.